It's The Wonky Show. We've got new research into students and the cost of living. There's fresh data out on the public perception of universities, and we round up the latest from the campaign trail. It's all coming up.
I do think that if that's not addressed, there is a real risk that the students who have time and money are able to become the type of graduates that universities want to produce, and the students who don't have time and money won't.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news policy analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to pin the higher education rosette on the policy lapel this week are three fantastic guests as always. In his office at the university, it's Paul Greatrix, registrar at the University of Nottingham. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was reading some exciting new research about toilet graffiti at Napier University in Edinburgh, which showed the importance of it to sustaining welfare in student life.
In the northern quarter of Manchester, it's Ed Marsh, Chief Exec of the Tudor Trust. Ed, your highlight of the week, please.
Yeah, beyond all of the amazing sport that's going on at the moment, Mark, I think for me, in the last week, one of the best parts of my job is going in and out of schools, and as GCSEs and SATs start to come to an end, it's just a lovely time in the school system.
And in North London, it's Debbie McVitty, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
It's one for the millennials from me. I went to see Taylor Swift in Liverpool at the weekend, and for once I was not in the city to do kind of university related things. I was just there as a tourist, went on a Beatles tour, saw Taylor at Anfield, and had an absolutely brilliant time.
Right, we start the week with new research into students and the cost of living. Paul, walk us through it.
So this is some really interesting research on Belong polling data from Wonky's partnership with Sybil, which is talking about the impact of money in students' well-being, mental health, satisfaction, so their entire student experience. And it kind of confirms what I think everyone in the sector suspected and feared, but actually does it in a really quite stark way, which really goes about showing the impact that finances have on every aspect of students' life, including critically how they engage with both their course but also their study facilities, student life in general, sports clubs, and so forth. So it's looking at the wider issues about the impact of money on this, but also about student engagement. So Sunday on the website has been talking about some research with Pearson on belonging and the cost of living as well. And what all of this shows, I think, is that we really have to address the issue of student financial support to ensure that everyone at university is able to get the most out of their student experience. It's a huge challenge for the sector.
Right. So, Ed, I mean, you deal with students that I guess are kind of upstream of this problem, and to use a kind of ridiculous policy wonk term for a kind of human issue, but people who might potentially go to university in the future. And what do you say to them about what it's going to be like and how to prepare?
Yeah, I think the sort of the young people in that sort of 14 to 18 year old demographic are really acutely aware of the sort of financial context that they're going to be going to university in. And I think post-pandemic, that awareness has significantly grown. And one of the big concerns that I quite often hear from that sort of next cohort of students is they just don't know how they'll be able to make the most of their time at university. So there's this sort of perspective, you know, sort of this view of going to university that you'll have the opportunity to volunteer, to join sports teams, to be part of clubs and societies. But then by the time they've worked out, well, I'm going to have to go to my classes and I'm going to have to work. There's just never any time left. And I think reading this report, one of the things that really came across strongly to me was the link between financial poverty and time poverty and the wider impact that has in universities.
And there is picks up a lot of the research we've been doing about belonging, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it really confirms. So we published some research with Pearson back in September, where we tried to look at some of the correlations between students' reported sense of belonging and how they reported they were getting on financially. And what we found actually was that a lot of the kind of factors around belonging, such as sort of academic confidence and kind of, you know, and sort of feeling of being able to, you know, do the work, there was no correlation at all. There's no sense that students who are struggling financially are in any way less capable or necessarily less sort of confident in their capabilities. studies. But it was very much about the kind of their practical ability to engage, and also I think about how that feeling of you know, the consequences of that in terms of their feeling of disconnection from their campus, from their peer group, from their learning environment, and then how that then kind of feeds into their sense of what it's like to be at university. You know, it for a lot of these students, and I think this comes out really well. And so we followed up with some of those students. Sunday did and sort of sat down with them and sort of said, tell me how this plays out in terms of your decisions day to day. And students are inevitably having to make some quite strategic decisions about where they deploy the resources that they do have, and they're making decisions about, well, do I attend class? Do I go to the social? If I go to one social, am I only going to feel more left out when it turns out I can't afford to go to others? You know, they're having to really, really think about these things. There's a lot of cognitive burden implicated in that as well. But also just for a lot of students, it's that sense of, I'm just getting through this. I just have to get through this. I just have to cope with this. What is really quite a miserable experience, in the hope that I can get that degree and get that graduate job. And of course, the real tragedy here is that their lack of ability to fully participate is going to also impact on their graduate job prospects. And we see that in the Belong data, where there's a direct correlation between sense of preparedness for the future and financial circumstances. The students who are struggling say they feel less well prepared. And, you know, so we really are going to start seeing this coming through in outcome data in the years ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Does it back up, Paul, what you're kind of experiencing on campus?
I mean, I think it is what's really hard about this. I mean, I have heard absolutely the stories that this data confirms, which is about students, you know, feeling under real challenge in terms of their ability to engage with their course, engage with clubs and societies, engage with social activities, because of the fundamental issue about lack of resources, and either having to, you know, to really scrimp to make ends meet, to use food banks, to try and find more work to fill the time, to get more money to survive on their course. And I do, you know, I am aware of all these stories. You know, we as a university and other universities I know do invest a huge amount of money in hardship and student support, scholarships and bursaries, to try and ensure that we kind of level up to enable everyone to have the same opportunities as the better off. But I do think it's something that absolutely does require a national perspective, because I am really, really worried that what we're talking about is a large proportion, and this data bears it out, a large proportion of students who feel that they're either in, you know, financial difficulty or just about surviving or in real financial difficulty, who are finding it utterly debilitating and really struggling to cope. And that has a profound impact then on every aspect of their experience, but also the services that universities need to provide in order to help get them through. So it's a really vicious circle, this one. And I think it's a real concern for the future.
Yeah, so discuss. Everyone discuss.
It's just the absolute irresponsibility, I think, of making it university's problem. And I think there's always been a problem since the whole time I've been in policy, you know, as my grey hairs will attest, ha ha ha. This idea that it's university's job to kind of bolster students' income, to provide hardship funds and bursaries and all the rest of it, because, you know, what you end up with then is universities that can afford it are able to do more, and they are often serving a smaller proportion of needy students and all the rest of it. But, you know, now we're really seeing the consequences of that, where it's possible for the government to say, well, the student maintenance grant loan is what it is, and if universities want to do more, they're sort of welcome to do that. And that's, you know, and it is just enormously insufficient. There are universities where the hardship funds are being distributed within the first 2 weeks of term, and, you know, this is not about students in hardship. This is hardship as a way of life. And Paul is absolutely right to say that this is a national problem. And but I suppose the real kind of problem, the real challenge here is that the scale of investment that would be needed to redress that problem at the national level is probably too great for a future government to contemplate. So I think we do need to be a bit creative about thinking about how to get integrate paid work, for example, more meaningfully with the educational experience. Perhaps Jim talks a lot in the team about giving students more time to complete their studies. I think there does need to be sort of pragmatic solutions, as well as essentially an uplift, you know, ideally restoration of the maintenance grant and an uplift in the maintenance loan and the thresholds for access to it.
I do completely agree to Debbie, and I agree that there are many other ways you can address this, but there are some pretty fundamental things about that need for maintenance. But I do think awareness on the part of universities, not just in relation to the basics financially, but also the implications and why this, you know, research is really helpful, I think, is what it shows is how it impacts every aspect of student life. So knowing that it's really hard for students to get by a whole day in the library if they haven't got enough to actually causes you to rethink how you provide for those students most in need in libraries, for example. It also, you know, makes the issues around sports participation much more stark as well. And requiring or demanding or insisting or encouraging universities to think about these things is also very important. So it does need to be a multi-dimensional response. But you're absolutely right. It can't all be down to universities alone to solve this. It has to be a national.
I think Paul is absolutely right about that. And it does, to me, speak to a kind of structural problem that universities are going to have to address, where if you look at the, you know, on the sort of prospectus of any university, it'll talk about the type of graduates that we produce and then, you know, in internal language sort of graduate attributes. And it'll list a load of things about civically minded leaders, entrepreneurs, people who've got real world experience. And so many of those things are things that are effectively extracurricular. So the things that you get from participation in a student's union or an unpaid internship or sports or whatever it is. And I almost feel like where this study leads is if those things are so core to the type of graduates a university wants to produce, it can't be left to extracurricular activity. It probably can't be co-curricular, actually. If we want graduates from universities to have opportunities to gain those skills, it's going to have to be embedded into the curriculum. And I think that probably raises questions for students' unions and careers departments and all sorts. But I do think that if that's not addressed, there is a real risk that the students who have time and money are able to become the type of graduates that universities want to produce, and the students who don't have time and money won't.
Yeah, what you would hope for, I think, from a future government would be a really integrated look at this. So I think one of the kind of, I think, weaknesses of the current system is, you know, we tend to look at, and this, I guess, the strength of the research is that we tend to look at student finance as being a policy area that is sort of separate from quality, for example. But we can see that, you know, it doesn't make sense to regulate universities on the basis of the outcomes that their students achieve if their students are not fundamentally empowered financially to do the engagement that would enable them to achieve those outcomes. And to integrate those two things requires thinking again about the structure of the curriculum, the way that things are delivered. It's not just about saying, well, let's make it online so it's flexible, but you've got to have more flexibility, and all the rest of it. And I think interestingly the Labour manifesto says, you know, we will strengthen quality and standards, which I think is a line that, you know, you have to put in every manifesto. I've sort of seen that since post-war, because, you know, we've got to improve quality. But there's an opportunity there, isn't there, to really look again at what we think quality is and what contributes to it.
But I agree with that, David. But I do think there is this sense in which it is really hard in a mass system to offer what is essentially, you know, personalised, tailored support. But that is what ultimately universities do have to do. There is an absolute role for government in terms of that sector-wide funding operation. But I do think it behoves universities to ensure that no student is left behind, right? That we are finding ways to ensure that we address the needs of our students properly as best we can within the frameworks that we've got to enable them to get the most out of their degree. And I know it sounds a bit hackneyed, but it is about levelling up. It is about trying to ensure that there is a platform that everyone is on as a minimum to enable them to get the most out of their degrees, but also ensuring that universities' support structures are attuned to providing that. But that is really difficult when you're in the middle of a funding crisis.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Sarah Hale, and this week on Wonky, Steve Leach and I from the Foundation Year Network have written about why funding cuts to foundation years should be a worry for everybody and not just the foundation year sector itself, and also why we need to start to think about how foundation years could be regulated and their quality assured in an appropriate and sensitive way so that they can continue to do the important work that they do for widening participation and, most importantly, for widening success.
Right, there's new polling out about what the public think about higher education. Debbie, walk us through it.
Yep, this is the Policy Institute at King's College London has commissioned a national poll about the public perception of universities and how that then might feed into both the general election and you know, presumably the policies of the government that ultimately wins it. There's some really good news in here for universities, actually. Universities are seen as among the best things that, you know, that Britain has to offer, you know, if you kind of up there with kind of, you know, the monarchy and the NHS. Net public approval of universities has improved since 1991, which was the kind of, there's different points of comparison throughout the polling, but you can see some of that trend data. And generally speaking, the majority of the public is quite positive about research and about the value of the research that universities do. This kind of narrative that a lot of research is a waste of time really doesn't hold. There are some caveats in there about things like vice chancellor pay. Is it too high? You know, that sort of ongoing debate. There's question, you know, there's a kind of a degree of skepticism about whether that kind of sense of quality and world leadingness applies throughout the whole university system. So you can see the influence of some of those kind of narratives about the sector kind of coming through. But generally speaking, a really good picture. The fly in the ointment is you know, universities, it confirms, are not a priority for voting in the election. And actually, education in general, and this, you know, schools are kind of quite low down the list as well. You know, education as a whole ranks lower than health, the economy, immigration, crime, public services, care, housing, the EU, any, you know, basically any other policy you can think of. Education comes lower, and that's a real change from 30 years ago, when education really, what, you know, political parties were kind of vying to be the kind of leaders in education. The other thing is, public doesn't really see that the university sector is facing serious funding pressures. That said, lots of evidence in there that there would be quite a lot of public concern if a university were to close, or indeed, particularly if there were to be mass closures of universities. And generally, people would blame the government. They would not see this as being universities' fault. They would very much see this as being a government problem. So that is the... That, I think, is a quite important takeaway for the next government to consider very closely.
Yeah, there's interesting. There's a lot in this, isn't there, Paul? I mean, the government of a day would get the blame for universities failing is sort of intuitive sense, isn't it? But it would give ministers pause for thought.
Absolutely, and I have to say, I mean, there's some really interesting data in here, and. From a position of being really quite concerned about public perceptions of universities over the past few years, because we have had such a kicking from the media and the current government about, you know, low quality courses and, you know, woke culture and free speech and all the rest of it. Actually, this is quite encouraging that there are still hard things that, you know, the public do value higher education. But it does show that there's a lot of work still to be done here. But I think you're absolutely right, Mark. I mean, it is an issue for the country if its higher education institutions start collapsing. Because, you know, just even beginning to think about the consequences of what may well be an anchor institution in a town or a city, with it being a huge employer, but also being a center of innovation and investment and growth, but an attractor for external investment through international students, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The profound impact of that loss would be extraordinary. And so I think it is really good to see that actually this, despite what the public says, may well become a real issue for a new government in having to find a way to support our sector. The one other thing I thought that was really interesting in the data, which does show the extent, I think, to which media coverage has cut through, is the finding that 41% of the public covered strongly agree that UK universities are more interested in making money than delivering high quality education or research. I mean, that's just staggering, because universities don't exist to make money. They're charities. They exist to educate and do research and create knowledge for the public good and to ensure that the country prospers. They don't, you know, they're not profit making. No one's shareholding in the most. So I find that absolutely extraordinary, really quite concerning. So if there's a job of work work to do for universities.
Yeah, definitely a job work. You put this against the public first polling we talked about a few weeks ago, which shows, you know, the public, you know, really, really don't want fees to rise, even with inflation. And it's deeply, deeply unpopular. And then you do another poll, but you ask them about, you know, how much they value universities like this. And, you know, it turns out really, really highly. So it's difficult to know what to take from what the public make of all this. I guess my personal theory is that all of this noise and the culture wars, I feel like that's kind of been designed to kind of suppress demand in higher education, to make people kind of a bit panicky and scared, and obviously to, you know, from the conservative end, to boost their sort of push on vocational stuff in rhetoric, if not in actual kind of policy. But that hasn't really worked. And my theory is that everyone's just kind of a bit confused.
I think you're right. I mean, but the demand, the latent demand for higher education is still there. And although, you know, we will be having a demographic dip in a few years, I do think the fact that we will now have many more people who are parents, who've been to university themselves, who have kids who are coming through the school system, who they will want to go to university too, will mean that the demand for quality higher education will continue into the future. And if anything, over the decades ahead, will only grow. So from my point of view, it remains a kind of principal job of any government to ensure that the right level of higher education is there to provide for the aspirations of the people of this country, but also critically, the economic success and the long-term sustainable future, right? Because a low-wage, low-skills economy is not going to be one that thrives on the international stage or is able to engage in the economic partnerships it needs to around the world. It's not a way to international success or long-term sustainability. So universities are absolutely at the centre of that. So, but I think you're right. It's a confusing time with all these mixed messages.
It does seem to me that it's setting up for a sort of post-general election Gordian knot, really, where all of the data, you know, coming out of universities suggests that there are some financial challenges ahead. All of the data from sort of the public suggests that they don't want universities to face financial hardship and certainly don't want them to go under. And Paul is absolutely right. Demand for universities continues to grow and nobody ever wants it to be their kids who miss out. But when you ask the public whether they think universities should get more money and in what way, they're at best lukewarm and actually in lots of ways quite opposed to it. I think the public first polling showed that it's less popular, you know, increasing tuition fees to $9,750, which wouldn't have directors of finance doing laps of, you know, celebration, is less popular than national service and marginally more popular than supervised toothbrushing, which is the least popular of all of the education interventions in any manifesto. So it does set up to me that there's something will have to happen in the next parliament, but whatever the government ends up doing, it's not going to be popular. And so there is going to be a real political price to be paid by a government for acting in this space, and therefore probably a really significant price to be paid by universities. And I think the earlier the higher education sector sort of comes together and recognises that, the better, really.
I think there's something quite interesting. I mean, as ever, you keep coming with polling data about HE funding, you keep coming back to the kind of pub, you know, the complexities of the system, wherein a fee rise does manifest as a kind of future graduate contribution, which in this poll, quite a lot of the public, you know, it was the most popular choice, albeit not chosen by a majority of the public. They certainly didn't want to see increases in taxation to fund universities. So, you know, there's always that sense of we want it to be good, but we don't really want to pay for it. But also we don't really understand how the system works, and fees sounds expensive, and that might, you know, that might be a problem for my kid or me. So, you know, that is a sort of a weird sort of artifact of the system. But I do also think it's, you know, whatever that kind of headline choice is made, it's looking like the kind of scale of Labour's majority might be such that actually it doesn't really matter if there's a bit of political kind of fallout in the early days anyway. But I think we've been kind of discussing this on the site and we continue to do so. It does sort of suggest that there's a need for some really just quite solid policy work, from an incoming government to sort of think through that kind of stability question, to think about what needs to be done very early doors to avoid the risk of university closure. And a lot of that stuff will go entirely under the radar. You know, this is not, you know, it will, but I think it's very helpful to know that were something like that to happen, there would be a genuine, you know, public perception challenge. It sort of situates universities as a hygiene factor. You know, you don't necessarily want them to be a priority. You just want them to keep ticking over in the background and doing good work, and you don't want to have to think about them too much. And I think, you know, to some extent, that's quite a legitimate position for the public to have, and one that in a way is quite helpful for the sector.
And thinking of it from a kind of dull administrative point of view, right? I mean, one of the things that has been part of the narrative over the past decade is how difficult it is to open a university and all the terrible bureaucracy and procedure. And that's part of what the Higher Education Research Act was intended to address. But if you think it's difficult to open a university, closing one is an absolute nightmare, right? And the consequences we've already talked about, but the actual sheer effort and administrative nightmare associated with it, actually closing a university, honestly, the scale of it is just frightening. You begin to think about the efforts required in relation to every one of those students, every one of those members of staff, all the assets, all the research contracts, all the international partnerships, all the rest of it. And that's before we get to the PR and the management of it. Then it's a nightmare. So let's hope it doesn't happen.
Yeah, certainly working for a Northern-based charity, you really do see the impact that those universities, where it's sort of a single university town, has on the area. And the prospects of one of those going under would be absolutely catastrophic. Totally agree, Paul.
There was some science and technology hustings this week in London. DK was there.
So the four national academies, the Campaign for Science Engineering and the Foundation for Science and Technology, got together to hold a pre-election hustings on science, research and innovation. It was really well attended, I think primarily because the Shadow Minister for DSIT, Shion Wura, was there, and it was a great chance to talk to her about the promises around science and research in the Labour manifesto.
We do need to be better at commercialisation, and we have made a commitment. It's in our life sciences plan, and it was also in response to our review conducted by Lord Jim O'Neill to set up a spin out, if you like. It's going to be a dashboard so that we working with universities, we look at how many spin outs are coming out of which universities. We look at in fact, the universities are doing this already, use it sort of having a easier framework for the issues around IP and how what support universities offer to spin out. So, and we'll also be working with in support of the universities clustering together to be real engines of regional economic growth, because it's absolutely key that the economic growth that comes from innovation isn't centred in simply one area. And we've seen Northern Gritstone, which has raised $320 million for investment in spin-outs of Northern universities, and we've got Midlands Mindforge, and we've got, I think,
Viscount Camrose, the Minister for AI, who's also associated with DSIT, and Lord Clement Jones from the Liberal Democrats, who was their science and technology spokesperson. It was ably chaired by Angie Ahuja, who is a science journalist at the FT. As usual with debates during an election campaign, we didn't move the needle a lot. There was no big policy announcements. We did get the chance to push Chion Wura on which of the key institutions would benefit from the decade of promised funding stability. Obviously, it's not in the manifesto. She wasn't going to announce anything at the debate. She confirmed it would be UCRI. She said she had the kinds of people they were thinking of in mind. And she even invited people to make representations if they felt that they should. The other big chunk was, I'm afraid, the performance of the Viscount Camrose. He described Rishi Sunak as a tech bro, which he felt meant somebody that was interested in science and technology. As our listeners know, also has a slightly different meaning and inference, which he didn't appear to be aware of. He also, when pushed on ideas for settling higher education finances, he leaned back on the Mickey Mouse courses discourse. He had a disdain for media studies, which he was called out on by all of the panelists. Andrea Hooge in particular, she cited Charlie Brooker of Black Mirror and Screenwrite fame as a hugely successful media graduate. Chiomura stressed the importance of a critique of media in a post-truth world. So it was really well attended. Pretty much anybody with an interest in science and technology policy was there. It did cover a lot of ground, which I've written up on the site. But at the end of it, it was another election debate, and you had to approach it from that sense. It was a good debate, but it didn't really give us anything new.
And now continuing our series on Manifesto Through History, Debbie's walking us through the 90s.
It is hard to overestimate the extent to which education was a political priority throughout the 90s, in a way that is much less the case today. Tony Blair famously said his priorities were education, 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 but this was off the back of more than a decade of conservative efforts to reform schools and drive up standards. We can see some of this filtering through into discussion of higher education, where the working assumption across all political parties continued to be that expansion of higher education was a good thing. At the start of the decade, the big HE agenda belonged to John Major's Conservative government, with a manifesto pledge to end the binary divide between universities and polytechnics, a pledge that was realised in the 1992 Further and Higher Education Act. By the time of the 1997 general election, higher education had continued to expand, but the UK was just coming out of recession and funding was scarce. In 1996, the Deering Committee convened and conveniently was not scheduled to report until after the general election, meaning that no political party was obliged to seek a manifesto pledge on higher education funding. But notably, Labour's manifesto argues that improvement and expansion of higher education cannot be funded out of general taxation. What we also see in the 90s is a greater focus among all political parties on technology transfer out of universities and into industry, reflecting a wider belief in what became known as the knowledge economy, the importance of investing in knowledge, higher level skills and innovation to build the economy of the future. This notion of the knowledge economy came to be heavily associated with New Labour and fell out of favour when they did. But in my article, I suggest that the knowledge economy created real value in the form of skills and knowledge inside universities. The challenge was about helping the wider economy make the best use of those skills and knowledge and realise that inherent value. That is, of course, a challenge that still persists today.
And the general election continues to rumble on, doesn't it, Ed?
Yes, it does, a bit like the Euros or the Cricket World Cup, Mark. There's research out this week from the NUS and HEPI, which is looking at sort of the constituency level impact of universities in this general election. And really, there are two big takeaways. So the first of those is the sort of democratic and the political impact of students. And I think there's some interest around the timing of this election and potentially where it means students will be. And the research finds that there's 50 constituencies where students potentially hold the balance of power. And that's probably slightly different to previous elections based on whether students will be at home or in university towns. And then the second area is the sort of impact that universities have on constituencies, and in particular, the impact of international students, and that it isn't sort of distributed, it isn't evenly distributed. So there's top 20 constituencies to benefit from universities getting something like £8.3 billion. That's from international students, the benefit of international students, whereas the bottom 20 only benefit from £88 million. And a sort of interesting way of sort of understanding that is that Keir Starmer's constituency in North London is one of the biggest beneficiaries, and the Clacton constituency that's attracting so much attention, I think, is the least benefited constituency. So a general election where universities and students have got a really big political impact, but also the sort of financial impact of international students is a big part of it as well.
It's just this question about the student vote is interesting, wasn't it? Because obviously you've got students living at home or not on campus. You've got, you know, it's hard to tell how successful universities and student unions have been in registering students at their term time address. So it's sort of difficult to kind of unpick whether the student vote in brackets is something meaningful at the election, coupled with the fact that HE issues aren't really being discussed on the national stage. That said, does that give a bit of an opening, Debbie? Because you know, for a sort of lack of students or HE issues, you know, could that galvanize students to turn out and say, actually, we want a voice here?
I mean, there's always a question, isn't there, to which the extent to which the student vote is a manufacture concept. And, you know, with having worked at NUS ourselves, we've sort of seen this before, where organizationally, we would be pulling together data that suggested that students could swing the election and using it to try and influence political parties to do things for students. And of course, there's been kind of moments in history where that's had unanticipated consequences, particularly in 2010 with the fees pledge. But certainly, you know, in 2017, there was this widespread perception that there was this kind of massive student, you know, youth quake, student swinging to Labour. And actually, that turned out to be perhaps slightly overstated. So, I'm not sure how much there is such a thing as a student vote. That said, I do think it's really important that students register. Obviously, it's really important that students register to vote, and that, you know, the in terms of kind of what information students are being given about where their vote might have an impact, and you know, where they're likely to be located at the time of their vote, it adds a level of complexity that means that the student vote is probably a bit less. I think the kind of key point of the HEPI piece was that the student vote could actually, if it exists, could actually be quite important, because there will be a number of seats in which students are returning to leaving a kind of extremely safe seat, typically for Labour, and going to a constituency in which their vote could actually begin to make a difference to the overall outcome of that seat. So I suppose it's really a question of the extent to which there's a kind of a live conversation with students about, you know, that the voter registration deadline was this week, you know, whether universities have been successful in achieving that, and then whether, I guess, particularly student unions are kind of doing the hard yards in encouraging students to cast their vote and have that influence.
One of the things I like about general elections is the theatre of it all, and I definitely enjoyed that back in the day when I was a student on campus in the 2015 general election. I'm curious, Paul, how much of that you're seeing on your campus.
I think that the real challenge is the timing, right? Because actually, for the vast majority of institutions, it is the end of term, and the election will be after the end of term, and therefore the kind of sense of things winding down, exams, celebrations, then graduation, it's actually all about dispersal. So it's very, very different. So the focus, as has been said during the year, was very much on registration, right? Because if you're not registered to vote, you can't vote, right? You've still got another hurdle in terms of voter ID, which both of these things are fundamentally designed to exclude young people and students in particular from the democratic process, right? And they've been engineered over a number of years, and I just remain utterly appalled by this, right? So universities and everyone in NUS have done their part as well in terms of trying to ensure that students actually were in a position where they were registered to vote, enabled to vote, and had the opportunity to vote. So we're approaching the end of that process now, where students who are registered will have the opportunity to cast their vote, some of them for the first time. And I just genuinely think it's just the most exciting thing that can happen, because I do think universities, quite a lot of universities, we certainly massively increased student registrations this year from, you know, in our previous campaigns, we never got over about 1,000 each year. This year we got to 26,000, which is over two-thirds of the student population for the first time, which is huge, right? Now, they will be distributed around the country, but they may well, as has been said in this survey work, have an impact in the constituencies where they are registered. But if you don't get registered, you don't get the vote. And that's one of the things that I think has been marginalising for student communities in the past. But it will be great. You won't be able to judge the impact of student vote this time, I don't think. But I really do hope that many, many, many students are actively participating this time, even if it's not visible on campus.
Yeah, I mean, I think the constant attempts to suppress the student vote really should be more of a national scandal than it is. That sort of photo that emerged of Johnny Mercer with his shoes and socks off on the train, where he was writing that memo to Downing Street, and it said that they weren't going to allow veterans to use their ID in order to vote, because it would open the floodgates to students. I mean, what a way to think about a portion of the population exercising their democratic rights, you know, that it would open the floodgates. The other part of the research that I just think is interesting is that there are 35 constituencies where students going back to them will be bigger than the majority, and all 35 of them are conservative. And it just, again, just raises that question whether or not perhaps the timing of this election might not be ideal for the Conservative Party.
I do think there's something very, you would expect, or I would have certainly expected to have seen in manifestos a bit more about, you know, particularly kind of Labour, a bit more about students, student well-being, student experience, student, you know, and frankly, student finance. And it's, you know, I think there are probably some who are disappointed by that. The Lib Dems have quite a lot to say about students, actually, including sort of things around duty of care and well-being, which is often the case. But I think the kind of consequence of that will be that there won't be that kind of sense of you know, we got you where you are. That would make Labour feel it had to do something for students. On the other hand, I think everything we've discussed today demonstrates, you know, the absolute necessity of doing something around particularly student finance, and I think the Labour Party is well apprised of that. So although I think there is that sort of sense of disappointment in terms of manifesto pledge, I hope that you know, whatever happens after the general election, that there will still be that, you know, that we will see that students have cast their vote and have made their voices heard in that way, and that will have an impact on subsequent policy making.
But Debbie, I do agree, but for many, many students, this will be their first opportunity to vote in a general election. And, you know, many of the issues that have assailed them over, you know, the past decade, have been ones that are not just about being a student. They're about every aspect of their life. And we were talking about, you know, issues around poverty earlier on. These things are not solely linked to their student status, although, you know, they are part of it. But it is an opportunity to engage with that wider policy agenda and be, you know, exercise a vote as a citizen in the way that everyone else is. So I think there's an awful lot to play for there. And I'm just so excited about the opportunity for students to participate in that process. It's easy to be cynical. It's easy to be turned off. It's easy to feel excluded by people who are trying to suppress votes. But actually, there is no, you know, greater privilege, in my view, than being able to exercise your vote in a ballot box for the party of your choice at a general election. It is genuinely transformative when done collectively by lots of people. And, you know, one of those moments is coming, and I just think it's incredibly exciting. And I realise that sounds incredibly naive, but that's the way I feel about it.
So that's about it for this week. To dig deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to stay ahead of everything going on in the UKHE, do make sure you subscribe to our briefing and intelligence services. Details are on the site. So thanks very much to Paul, Debbie and Ed, and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.